The St. Augustine Institute of Catholic Studies presents part one of a two-part discussion on the history of St. Benedict's Center and the Doctrinal Crusade. Brother Michael will be the moderator, and Brother Francis will discuss the history from the beginning. Two lay supporters, Robert Koenig and Robert Cohen, will assist in the discussion. This is Thursday, May 17th, 1984. Brother Michael.
Thank you, Robert. There's a quote here that we begin our little booklet called The Architects of Confusion with, and it kind of will set the mood for tonight's discussion. And it's from Time Magazine, an October the 14th issue, 1974. And it's just a short clipping. Father Feeney's undoing was his hard-line reading of the formula that outside the Church there is no salvation. In the years since Feeney's excommunication, Catholicism has grown remarkably tolerant of far-left theologies. That's from the religious news writer in Time magazine, but that's, if anything, would indicate the fact that we have gone far, or the Church has grown very tolerant of far-left theologies. We certainly are seeing that today. But tonight's discussion is on the history of the Crusade. And we are going to be directing questions at Brother Francis, who is the only one who can really give us a full historical view of St. Benedict's Center from its beginning up until today. He's the oldest member of the order. He's one of the co-founders of the Crusade, along with Father Feeney and Sister Catherine. I will let him give his own credentials as far as his own accomplishments in the field of study and in the field of teaching, but he comes to us by way of Lebanon and came over as a young man, and when he found Father Feeney, as he was doing some summer studies, I believe, at Harvard University, he came across Father Feeney and was so impressed with Father that became Father's first disciple and has given him the support for the rest of his life. So I will ask Brother Francis to give us just a brief summary before we go into specific questions about the Crusade in general and the highlights of the Crusade, the most important points that it came up across over the years.
Before you start firing questions at me, I hope I'll be ready to answer them. I think I should give a chronological review, very brief, of the history of the center from the beginning. St. Benedict Center was started on the Feast of St. Joseph, March 19, 1940. Therefore, since this is the year 1984, the center is 44 years old. The very length of time is impressive. We have seen hundreds of movements come and go during these years. So there must be something that even our adversaries, and their name is Legion, admit is admirable. What is the secret of the staying power of the center? With all the forces that have tried to stop us, the center still goes on. The crusade still goes on. Now, what was it exactly that started on that March 19, 1940? Actually, it was a small group of Catholics in the neighborhood of Harvard University who wanted to get to know the Catholic faith better. And so they formed themselves into what you might call a study group, since it later became a real institute of studies, a real school, you might say. It was already in seed a school. Now, schools don't usually become crusades, but this school did eventually turn into a crusade. A crusade is a war, but in this case it was a spiritual war, and its weapons were spiritual weapons. And I will have to give some explanation of why, in the case of St. Benedict's Center, what started to be a school of study became a crusade. The crusade eventually developed a religious order, which we call the Slaves of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. So to return now quickly to the dates, in 1940 the center was started. The leaders of the center at the time, not one of them is with us at the moment. The most important person in that group was Sister Catherine, who died in 1968. The two co-founders with her, I don't think they would want to be connected with our work at the moment. Actually, both of them are now priests. Their names are Monsignor Christopher Huntington and Father Avery Dallas. In 1942, Father Leonard Feeney started to come regularly to the center and to give regular lectures at the center. And about that same time, I myself became one of the teachers of the center under Father Feeney's direction. In 1946, we started issuing a magazine from the housetops. If we had not published that magazine, I wonder if we would have been heard of very much further than Harvard Square. No matter how interesting or exciting or challenging or annoying things we were saying, they would have been contained in the neighborhood of Cambridge. Our magazine from the housetops, which was resumed after many years of interruption and is still the main platform of the Rational Crusade, at the time did not have many subscribers, but it did reach some very sensitive nerves. It was sent to all the Catholic universities, to all the seminaries, and many of the thinkers in the church that were fascinated by Father Feeney, had become his friends at the time when he was the literary editor of America. They all were interested in anything that had Father's spirit, and many of them were receiving the housetops, and some of them were writing for it. It was the publishing of the house from the housetops that led to the explosion that occurred in 1949, when the center was heard of, you might almost say, all around the world. In 1949, four professors or teachers connected with the center were fired from the Jesuit College, Boston College. I was one of the four. The reason that the Father Rector, Father Kelleher, gave was that we were teaching doctrines that lead to bigotry and intolerance. Father Feeney came to the defense of the four professors, and in a few days after that, Archbishop Cushing silenced Father. So all that was in 1949. In 1950, Pope Pius XII issued an encyclical, Humani Generis, and I will be referring to the circumstances of that encyclical and how we heard about it and how the Holy Father defended without any qualification the position that we had proclaimed. In 1953 is probably the most eventful year in the history of the center. I will be talking about it a great deal, and many of the documents that I will probably be reading or referring to date to that. Let us just identify it now as the year in which Father Feeney was supposedly excommunicated. It was the height of the smear campaign against us. There was an attack on Father's priesthood. I will be talking more about that. And the center rose up to defend what we know by our faith, that a priest once a priest is a priest forever. And that was a battle that we decidedly won. The excommunication was countered by a complaint of nullity, to which we will be referring later. In 1950, the center began to preach the faith on Boston Common and continued to do that without any interruption. The whole group of the center, about 100 people, and if you count our friends and what we always called the Third Order, we were about 200 people. We arrived at the common and we set up a little platform and we stood up to preach and explain the faith and defend it. I will be talking more about that. That continued without any interruption. Every Sunday, rain or shine, that was the challenge we gave. And even in a blizzard, we would arrive there, make a profession of faith, and people would come to see if we are keeping our word. For exactly seven years and a half, with no interruption whatsoever. By that time, there was a very strict rule on the papers in Boston. It was never referred to in the Boston papers, even though the crowds were estimated in the tens of thousands at times on Sunday. But it eventually made national papers. Life magazine had almost an issue specially on the events of the Boston Common. In 1954, we left Cambridge and we came to where we have continued to live ever since, Still River, which is part of the town of Harvard. The joke always was that we ran away from Harvard to Harvard, from Harvard University to the town of Harvard. And Sister Catherine lived with us in Harvard only 10 years. She died exactly 10 years after we had come to Harvard. And Father Leonard lived exactly 20 years. So we came to Harvard in 58, Sister Catherine died in 68, Father Leonard died in 78. That's about the brief summary of the center as an institution, as an organization. Now, I would like to say a few words, again, before I start receiving your questions. I already suggested the point of the question, why is it that a study group, a group of Catholic young men and women who wanted to become more spiritual, study the lives of the saints, the history of the church, the writings of the fathers and doctors, the whole thing connected with an attempt to become more spiritual, more devotional, how would that turn into a crusade? And the answer is simple. It wasn't long before the studies at the center began to reveal a tremendous opposition between Catholic thought, Catholic truth, Catholic dogma, if you want, and many of the trends in the world today. At the center, we studied and believed the revelations of God in Holy Scripture. We were, therefore, immediately confronting an age dominated by scientism, by higher criticism, becoming doubtful about God's revelation. Also, we discovered that the Catholic faith holds that there is one truth that cannot be duplicated, singular and unique, that God established and made the way to salvation, the essential way to salvation. The modern world was becoming more and more liberal, allowing truth became somewhat relative, subjective. There was a tendency to be anti-dogmatic. There has been movements outside the church for the last few centuries. They could be somewhat summarized as Masonic philosophy that are in opposition to dogma, that had been aiming at destroying what today they call the triumphalism of the Catholic dogmatic stand. While these forces were on the outside of the church, there was a healthy opposition going on. The church immediately opposed these trends, and an intellectual battle was going on. But something had happened. That philosophy infiltrated the church, and suddenly what was once attributed to people like Rousseau and Voltaire, there were people right within the church who were talking and acting by the same Masonic principles. So the infiltration of the church, that was one of the things that we began to realize. The conspiracy against the Christian thought, the Christian morality, has gotten inside the church. So out of that realization arose the issue of our spiritual war that we call the St. Benedict Center Doctrinal Crusade. In the moral order, for example, situation ethics, the subjectivism in matters of morality, instead of being guided by objective principles, the person was left to decide the moral behavior for himself. Freudianism, Darwinism, all these forces that had been undermining faith, first from the outside, suddenly we discovered that they were infiltrating the thinkers within the church, the schools, the universities of the church. That is the situation that led eventually to what we now call the Doctrinal Crusade of St. Benedict Center. Now I would give you a chance to ask me questions. Any special point you would like me to develop or?
Well, I'm sure we have tons and tons of questions. I think Bob has one, so I'll let Bob Koenig start off with.
Well, mine isn't really a question. I noticed earlier, Brother, just so the listening audience gets it straight, I think you said that the order or the group moved from Cambridge out to Harvard in 1954. You meant 58 then. They moved out in 58, and sister died 10 years later in 68. Yes, that was the point I was...
If I ever said 54, it was in a slip of the tongue. Yeah, we left Cambridge in 58.
But to follow with a question then, Brother. When did Father Feeney become crusader for the doctrine? When did he become aware of the fact that this was the key doctrine that was undermining it was a keystone of the attack on the church?
Father Feeney was always very strong on doctrine even before he came to the center. He was beginning to be aware of something that we understand much better today, of the assault on the church, the satanic attack on the faith. I could best explain that by one of the charming poems that he wrote in the year 1935, which would be 7 years before he came to the center. It appeared in one of his charming poems among them, and very few people paid any attention to it. It was entitled The Hound of Hell. The occasion was the baptism of a little child. And as he was administering the baptism, he had a tremendous intuitive fear of what is going to happen to this child as it grows to be a man or a woman. Pray for the fragile daughter and the frail infant son, whom at the font the baptismal water I pour upon. The cycle has swung to sorrow. Our ranks have begun to fail. We know not what gate of hell tomorrow will not prevail. This is very beautiful, in that knowing with his strong faith that the gates of hell are going to be trying in a very special, mysterious way to destroy the church and destroy the faith, and yet that by the words of our Lord they will not prevail. The foam at the mouth is frothing in the beast with the flashing tooth, the hound that was sent on the scent of nothing has found the truth. Now this mysterious paragraph, stanza, will illuminate the thing that Brother Michael has been writing about recently, that vision of Leo XIII when he saw the conversation between our Lord and Satan. And Satan wants to go after the church and destroy it. And for the mysterious reason, in the inscrutable judgment of God, God allowed him 100 years, which we hope are coming to an end very soon, as a matter of fact, on October 13. So we have gone through a century in which the arch enemy of the faith has been allowed the liberty to try to destroy the church in a way that has no parallel in the 20 centuries of Christian history. So the foam at the mouth is frothing in the beast with the flashing tooth, that's Satan, of course. The hound that was sent on the scent of nothing has found the truth. The guns will be hard to handle. In the forts we will soon forsake. Pray for the light of the single candle or the birthday cake. So the single candle on the birthday cake, the child that was 1 year old in 1935, our Father Feeney was saying, what is going to be the future of this little baptized Catholic with the forces that he began to sense gathering against the faith. Now, I would say that when Father called us to his room after many weeks of thought and prayer and made that prophetic statement that I never can forget, because it's the reason why I have dedicated my whole life to this crusade. He said, I have finally placed my finger on the one cause behind all that has been happening to the church. The weakness of faith, the destruction of morals, the corruption of family life, and so on and so forth. All the other things that are happening as a consequence, they all begin from the fact that the enemy has succeeded in destroying a very fundamental dogma of faith that outside the church there is no salvation. That was about the year 1944. I would say that it wasn't enough for Father Feeney to have seen that. He had to have disciples. He had to have people that would support him to take that stand. And that was a fact. He always said it. He said, I could do nothing unless I had spiritual children to support me. I think the Center Crusade would be inconceivable were it not for several persons that had somehow been heading in that direction. Certainly, one is Sister Catherine. I could somehow show how Sister Catherine was heading in that direction too. When we published the From the Housetops, one of the first articles that Sister Catherine published was entitled The Failure of Interfaith. And I would like to read a couple of paragraphs from it. She says, now interfaith was what we called in those years the thing that now is called ecumenism. Now even the Pope and many bishops have been saying that there is such a thing as false ecumenism. But as far as we are concerned, we don't even know any other variety of ecumenism today except the false ecumenism. Ecumenism, what the center was protesting was not friendship between Catholics and people of other beliefs. For that kind of friendly relation, the center was always enthusiastically and joyfully for. In that article, Sister Catherine says, association of Catholics with Protestants as people has unquestionably made for pleasant intercourse among the participants. In all the matters where Catholics have to cooperate with their fellow men, fellow countrymen, where there is a legitimate place for cooperation, the center absolutely believes in cooperation. It's when it touches the faith, when it gets to compromise the dogmas of the faith, that's where we draw the line. Now, Sister Catherine says, and here I quote, there is a difference between Catholics and Protestants. There is most certainly a doctrinal difference, and this cannot long escape manifesting itself in any except the most superficial intercourse between the two groups. If there is not an intransigent difference manifested at a religious group meeting, then somebody is giving ground. A transaction in which a Protestant has nothing and a Catholic everything to lose. It would undoubtedly seem that the interfaith meetings imply a dishonesty. People who know they have fundamental differences in religion agree to get on a platform and make believe that these differences do not exist irreconcilably. It was distressing to hear recently a graduate student from a nearby college define an interfaith meeting as a place where a Jewish rabbi who does not believe in the divinity of Christ and a Protestant minister who doubts it gets together with a Catholic priest who agrees to forget it for the evening. Sister Catherine goes on to say, The Catholic man in the street is not found at interfaith gatherings. Intellectuals or semi-intellectuals make up interfaith groups. To the Catholic man in the street, they do not make sense. They do not make sense to him because he is simple in heart, and the simple of heart often arrive at the truth of things more directly than their academic brothers, who depend upon their own discursive powers for their conclusions. The simple man knows that it would be impossible to get all the members of an interfaith gathering to say together one Hail Mary. Now, I think this was written before Father made that statement. This was written before, you might say, the Center Crusade, as centering in the dogma no salvation outside the church, was proclaimed. Because the spirit of the Center from the beginning was to seek and say the truth fearlessly and with no compromise. I could add my own personal experience. Certainly, when I came to the Center, I had come back to the faith of my ancestors. I do come from an ancient Catholic family, but my father had wandered from the faith, becoming a Mason, and I grew up in an atmosphere where for a while I joined the Protestant denomination of my mother. I came to the faith studying philosophy at the University of Michigan, a very unlikely situation for a Catholic conversion. And as I made my profession of faith, an abjuration of heresy which was required of me before I would be baptized, the priest, at the time Father Alan Babcock, who later became Bishop of Grand Rapids in Michigan, as he was receiving me and asking me to make my abjuration of heresy, and I had to say, I, and here I had to use my secular name, most people know me now as Brother Francis, but then I was Fakhri Malouf. I, Fakhri Malouf, having before me the Holy Gospels, which I touch with my hand, and knowing that no one can be saved without that faith which the Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church holds, believes, and teaches, against which I grieve that I have greatly erred, inasmuch as I have held and believed doctrines opposed to her teachings. I now, with sorrow and contrition for my past error, profess that I believe the Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church to be the only and true church established on earth by Jesus Christ, to which I submit myself with my whole soul. Now, I noticed as I was making this abjuration of heresy that the priest who was administering it was very much embarrassed by it and was trying to teach me how to make mental reservations. And I objected to that instantly. I said, this is the most important step I have made in my life, and I have to make it with absolute simplicity, with no counter thoughts. So when I came to St. Benedict Center, maybe I should be telling a little bit here the personal story of how I met Father Feeney. I got my degree in philosophy. I got the doctorate in 1942, and I would have returned to my country, which is Lebanon, at the time. But the war was on, and there was no possibility of travel at the time. So I was given a postgraduate fellowship at the University of Harvard, and that's how I came to Cambridge. All the time I was hoping to meet a priest who would teach me fully the complete theology of my faith. I had absolute certainty that I finally found the truth, but I wanted to know it thoroughly. And I had made many novenas that God will send me a teacher that would teach me the Catholic truth. While at the University of Harvard, I met a priest who later introduced, told me about the Center and told the Center about me. And he brought me an invitation, an urgent invitation, to go and meet the people at the center. And I came, and the first time I came, Father was giving one of his famous Thursday night lectures. The room was absolutely crowded with people. But after his lecture, I was just ready to leave when a messenger came to me from Father's room, said Father would like to talk to me. I hadn't known Father, I hadn't met him, so I was very surprised. I said, "You must be mistaken, he must have sent you for somebody else." He said, "Oh no, I'm sure it is you that he wants to speak to." So I went back to speak to Father, and I said to him, why did you want to know me? I'm very happy to meet you, but why did you send for me? And Father said to me, after everybody had left the room, "Because you agreed with every single thing I was saying." Now that surprised me. I said, "Well, Father, everybody seemed to agree with you." He said, "Yes, I know. They enjoy my jokes, they applaud, they laugh, and so on. But once they leave this room and go back to their materialistic, socialistic, Masonic professors," he said, "they forget everything I taught them. But I sensed that there was one person in the room who was for every single thing, seriously, that I stood for." Well, that was my first introduction to Father. I would say I was prepared fully in my spirit for the crusade. I knew that there was a definite conspiracy against Catholicism, against the faith. Not because I read about it in books, but because I lived in its atmosphere. But it was only when Father came out, I would, if anybody had asked me, "Is there salvation outside the church?" I would certainly have said, "No, there isn't. That's the one true faith established by Christ for salvation. Anybody who wants to save his soul has to discover it." But I would not have put it in the first place of importance. I would have said that when people deny it, it's one other Catholic truth that they are denying. The way they deny the creation as told by God, the way they deny the reality of the Eucharist, the way they deny the real presence in the Blessed Sacrament, it would be just another truth. But I would not have seen that this is the truth that the enemies, and behind them the arch enemy, have directed their guns to destroy. And once they have destroyed it, they have reduced the Catholic faith to something that to be where they want it to be. It ceases to be the challenge that it has always been in the world. It was only after Father said that that I could see clearly that this is not an issue, but the issue.
When you say, brother, the enemy, would you say the Judaic Masonic conspiracy, as Father referred to it, or what do you mean by the enemy?
The enemy is Lucifer. That's the enemy of the Church. But anybody who denies the divinity of Jesus Christ has become part of his movement against the faith. So what we stand for is opposed by the Masons, by the Jews, by the Protestants, as well as by Muslims or pagans or what you have.
As far as an organized conspiracy to destroy this dogma, I remember we had read in the Social Contract of Rousseau that he said anyone who would say that there's no salvation outside the Church, let him be cast outside of the Masonic state. So would you say that Masonry, the higher echelons of it as such, are definitely plotting the destruction of the Church?
Yes, I would say that in the last 2 or 3 centuries, the greatest force that has been assailing the Church, that has been attacking the Church in all the countries of the world, but especially in the Christian or especially in the Catholic countries, has been masonry.
Now, we have a lot of questions, Brother Francis. I don't know how much time do we have left. We will make this 2-hour segments, so we have about 20 minutes. I have a lot of questions here that can be answered probably quite briefly. If you want to develop it and provide any documentation, I see you have a lot of reference books before you. Feel free to do so, but I'd like to cover a large gamut of what the characters were that made up St. Benedict Center and the activities that you did in Harvard, in Cambridge, before you came to Still River. The first thing I think the audience should know is who is Father Feeney, the tremendous personage involved here. It's not no ordinary priest. I mean, the fact that he's a Jesuit makes him kind of extraordinary, either in a good or a bad sense today, but tell us a little bit about Father's credentials and the tremendous impact that he had, even aside from St. Benedict Center.
Father Feeney unquestionably was a great preacher. People are talking about his hypnotic power. That's ridiculous. I mean, there was no hypnotic power. He was a great preacher. The way St. John Chrysostom was a great preacher. I remember the day when Frank Sheed, whom I knew, visited us and sat beside me listening to one of Father's lectures on Thursday night. And at the end of the meeting, he took me aside. He said, "Nobody knows the Catholic world, especially the English-speaking Catholic world, as I know it. I was born in Australia, I have lived in Canada, I married a very distinguished lady in Britain, and I have influence and friends all over the United States. And I can tell you this, what you heard tonight, there's absolutely nothing like it anywhere in the English-speaking world." He said, "I know that you appreciate your father, but I am telling you that you better do. You really have something extremely unique." Father was a priest every inch. The first interest he had in anybody he was talking to was his salvation. I really believe that he did have the charisma of in a miraculous degree. The way he picked me out of a room of hundreds of people, saying that I did agree with everything he said. I mean, I never knew anybody in my life that would do a thing like that, and he did it. And he didn't know me. He didn't even know who I was or anything. He certainly was a great spiritual director. Over a period of very few years, he made about 300 converts, but they were not just ordinary converts. They were very difficult, sophisticated intellectuals. And their conversion was to be the beginning of something tremendously great, if his work had not been hindered. He directed about 100 people to religious life. That's at a time when vocations were couldn't be more rare and dying. So he certainly was given many, many great graces to be the leader of a crusade, like the crusade of St. Benedict Center. But besides the preacher and the theologian and the spiritual director, Father was also a poet and a tremendous humorist, a tremendous sense of humor. And these are the aspects that the people completely lost sight of. And he never lost it. He never lost it. Somebody said about him, he was as American as Mark Twain while being as Catholic as St. Francis of Assisi. I think that's absolutely a perfect description of Father Feeney.
And it says here in the Architects of Confusion, this is a Father McElhaney who later was to become the Archbishop of Jamaica. He once referred to Father Feeney as the greatest theologian we have in the United States by far. Isn't it true the Father would sometimes back or replace Fulton Sheen on the Catholic Hour on the national radio?
Yes, when Archbishop Sheen was on national radio, on the radio, on the Catholic Hour, and he had to be absent for a few weeks, when they asked him whom would he suggest to take his place during his absence, without any hesitation, he said, "Father Leonard Feeney." And Father gave those lectures, and we do have at least one of them on record.
Father also came from a great Catholic family. He had two brothers, priests, all of whom have since died, Father Thomas Feeney, a Jesuit, and Father John Feeney, who was a secular priest. So all three have gone to their eternal reward.
I had the great privilege of visiting their family the first Christmas in New England. I spent at the Feeney family in Lynn, and it was absolutely a first-rate Catholic family in every respect. The father, the mother, the three priests, their sister, and then they did have an adoptive sister who became a nun.
So, unfortunately, myself, I knew Father Feeney just for a few years before he died, so I never knew him in his prime, but I just wish I had. But I get to know him more and more when I read the books the Father wrote, especially his theology and the Bread of Life. Now, Sister Catherine was also a very dynamic person. You used to tell us, I never knew Sister Catherine, but she was quite a historian, is that right?
Yes, I would say that among the three, the center became a school, and the school became more and more important. And eventually we had many students. In the period after the Second World War, there were lots of young men and women who had been in the armed forces that used their GI Bill to study at the center, and the center became a very important school. Father, of course, was the theologian and was the one who taught us how to read and interpret Holy Scripture. It was my field to be the philosopher, but I was gradually attracted to the field that Father was in, and eventually I did a great deal of study on Holy Scripture, and I took the whole course of theology with Father. Sister Catherine was the historian, and her knowledge of the conspiracy was the knowledge of a historian. She knew the concrete facts in what she called the invisible government.
And this can be at least partially read in the Glorious Popes, right?
Her Glorious Popes was entirely written by Sister Catherine, and it shows how there was, from the beginning, from the birth of the Church till our time, there has always been a force working against the Catholic faith.
How big was the, or rather, how large was the student body, so to speak, of the school then, brother?
At one time, I would say there were over 100.
Over 100.
Yeah.
And this was...
It was always a small school.
But this was fully accredited, is that correct?
Yes, it was fully accredited. And after the controversy, of course, the Monsignor Hickey, who was the Vicar General, wrote a letter saying that they removed their approval of us. And without any change in the academic status, the state of Massachusetts removed the GI Bill, the right for the students to use their GI Bill at the center. That's at a time when people were getting that benefit to study how to ride bicycles.
Where was the school located, brother?
And that's one of the few cases that we never succeeded in winning in the courts. The school was located at the center, across from St. Paul's Church, right beside the Widener Library.
Harvard Square. Why did Sister Catherine choose Harvard Square to found the center?
The idea of the center was to be a kind of a rescue station for Catholic young men and women losing their faith in the many academic universities of great prestige in the Harvard area. Well, obviously, Harvard University was by far the most prestigious, and the place was chosen to be as close to Harvard as possible. Although eventually students were coming from all the different universities and colleges in the greater Boston.
There's an awful lot of them, too.
The center was never meant to be a Newman Club. That's very important. People think of the center as having been some kind of a Newman Club. A Newman Club somehow becomes part of the non-Catholic institution. And it's a kind of somewhat an encouragement to students and even to parents to send their children there, as if, you know, that would be adequate to take care of their faith, even though they are being placed in an anti-Catholic atmosphere. Now, the center was never to be there and never became part of Harvard University, but was to be in the neighborhood available to people that have problems to come and meet somebody to help them with their problems, whether intellectual, academic, or spiritual.
So the you said before that Father Feeney came to the center in 1942. The Jesuits assigned him to the center?
Yes, Father was assigned, was requested by the Archbishop to, and was assigned by the Jesuits to be the leader of the center.
He was there primarily to aid Catholic students going to, or any students going to non-Catholic universities in the area, to help them either keep their faith or learn about their faith.
That's right. But eventually, of course, many non-Catholics got interested, and he had a large convert class. He always had about 50 people that were in the process of becoming Catholic.
I think you told me that at its prime, sometime in the early 40s, that Father in 1 year converted 200 and sent 100 of them off to different religious orders.
Well,
is that about right?
You said that yesterday, and I was going to correct you, but I didn't have a chance.
Oh.
Well, no, it wasn't in 1 year. It was in a few years.
Well,
actually, the number of converts was not 200, but 300, but it was over a period of a few
years. Shame on Father for being so slow.
Yeah. What was going on at Harvard University that gradually began to dawn on Father about diabolic influence? What were some of the... I read in the, I guess it was the Bread of Life, about suicides that were taking place frequently there.
Apart from the fact that the whole academic atmosphere of Harvard was becoming what we would call, in the language of today, journalistically, going as left as a university could go left, both in socialism as in every other respect, every course given at Harvard was slanted against the faith. You can almost say without exception. The philosophy taught there was absolutely subversive. If it wasn't skeptical, it was not... There were people teaching their doctrines that couldn't be distinguished from Hitler or Stalin. Hmm. But what annoyed Father even more was when the Jesuit order started sending their future teachers to be educated at Harvard. And what he saw, when he saw what was happening to those teachers, they were not defending their faith. They were not even protecting their own personal faith. And he could see how that kind of, these philosophies were eventually going to be carried over to Catholic universities.
Nuns as well were going...
Nuns, priests.
It's a shame, but...
And he began to see how many students were losing the faith. I mean, the problems coming to him. I remember one day when a very knowledgeable person came and told Father that in the building right across from St. Bernard Center, Adams House, one of the prestigious fraternity houses, in one term, not in 1 year, there were 6 suicides.
That's,
and they were hushed up. The Father was able to get to one of them because one conscientious student ran to Father to see if he couldn't do something to the boy before he died. And Father used to say, "Why are these boys killing themselves? They don't have enough to eat. They have no future. They come from the wealthiest, most prestigious families in the whole country." The professor was standing up there watching the boy die, and would say, "Oh, that's very unfortunate." Father said, "Unfortunate." He said, "That's what you teach them. That's what's getting them into that state. The philosophies of despair, of materialism, of degeneracy that are leading them to that." So that's why Father got to be more and more of a fighter. I mean, at first he was talking like a poet, like a lecturer, like an academician, but gradually facing the realities of the situation, he turned into
the
fighting
challenge.
Priest that the world finally discovered.
Yeah, well, today I think we'd see a lot more. I mean, suicide is on the increase due to the satanic influence of the media, rock music, and the whole university atmosphere. But a lot of the young people escape today by way of drugs and alcohol. alcohol was available, I'm sure, back in the 50s and 40s, but drugs probably were not. But six suicides in one semester is frightening.
In one house.
In one house. It's absolutely frightening. But with the two Roberts with me, there's a subject here that I wanted to talk briefly about before we end the first hour lecture. And that it's kind of a psychological question. In the second half of this discussion, we'll talk more about specific events and that many of the listeners are anxious to know about, like the excommunication, Cardinal Cushing, Pope Pius XII, which we haven't got into yet. So don't despair. The second half of this discussion, we're going to answer a lot of the questions that you're more familiar with. But before I do that, there's a psychological element that has to be taken into consideration. At the time Father Feeney was defending the dogma and Sister Catherine, we had just finished the war, and a lot of the boys coming in and out of the center were coming back from the war. They had lost close friends, and the horrors of bloodshed and death stared them straight in the face. Then we had the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where 200,000 were wiped away in 2 seconds. Now, what was the effect on the mind of Father Feeney of the war as such, as a punishment for sin? I mean, spiritually, how do you relate war, especially modern wars, with the denial of the faith?
Father told us many times that the wars of this century have been Masonic wars, and that they were absolutely unjustified. To a great extent, they were a punishment on the weakness of faith, that the people were being punished for their lack of loyalty to the faith. And of course, the dropping of the atomic bomb was, as it was to the whole world, was quite a shock. Sister Catherine refers to that in the Loyolas and the Cabots, that something new occurred in the minds of everybody when that event took place.
They were wars, certainly in that sense, in my opinion, brother. But even more than that, or in addition to that, they were totally contrived wars. World War I was planned from the beginning and executed, and World War II was planned right at the end of World War I and executed.
That's correct, absolutely.
And honorable men that I know of in my reading, like General Douglas MacArthur, were totally opposed to the use of the atomic bomb on people.
When we were being told at the center, and we were saying it loudly, that there was a very definite conspiracy, an invisible government, that the people that we see in the headlines are not always the people who really are running the world, the nations, I don't know that there was any other group in the whole country that was saying that. I think now that fact is very widely realized, that most people now admit that fact.
And the one thought that comes to my mind is that, is the inspiration of the Holy Ghost throughout all this turmoil of the modern age, that the doctrine is so necessary to be preached, the devil just hates the sound of it. And with modern communication, it can reach the world in such a short time. And living in an age when you have the modern technology that we do, and if the sins of the world merit another chastisement by way of a war, this dogma must get out to reach these people.
Please go to tape 2.